You are listening to a sermon by Ken Friesen, recorded on Sunday, July 21st, 2013, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
So I am going to speak on Pope Francis. I was asked by Andre to do so. I think that's because I've mentioned popes in previous talks before. And Catholicism has played a role in my life, partly because I lived in Quebec for a couple of years, going to school, and went to Catholic Mass at various times. But Catholicism wasn't really known to me when I was young. When you're young, you just like any other age, you know what you know. And what I knew was that my family was Mennonite, that we were primarily interested in music, church, and school. And so, as Mennonites, the defining aspect of our Christian life was our idea that, as Mennonites, we were different from others, that we had a series of unique features that separated us as our family and us as a church community from other communities, including people attending non-Mennonite churches such as Catholic churches. Over time, one develops a basic understanding of the differences between churches and their beliefs. Some of that you learn on the street. My introduction to Catholic beliefs mostly came from my friendship with an Italian neighbors who lived just up the street. And I got to see them both in terms of the church and in terms of culture. And I clearly saw that they had some cultural legs up on us. Most significantly, their food was a lot better, and I spent a lot of time at their house. My buddies attended Catholic school and attended Catholic Mass. And later in high school, I would occasionally join them for 5 p.m. Saturday Mass. And that was a place where a large contingent of Little Flower Academy girls attended as well. So I got introduced. It was a little odd for me to attend both Protestant and Catholic church, but I would often attend Catholic Mass. Now, I remember the understanding of the differences between Catholicism and Protestant thought concerned issues of the role of Mary and the role and significance of the Pope. I remember that it was presupposed that Catholics were somewhat deficient for not having what we thought was a personal relationship with Christ that was different from theirs. And when I attended Columbia Bible Camp, which is now known as Stillwood, I remember cabin discussions about Catholicism, where the majority opinion was that Catholics were not, in fact, Christians. And when I attended Mass, I saw the differences between Catholic Mass and our own church setting, and mine was the MB setting. There I perceived some strict differences between the priest and the laity. In some manners, I reckoned it would be easier to be Catholic than Mennonite. I did not appreciate until much later the differences within the Catholic Church itself between the various different orders. The Jesuits were known to me when I was quite young only by their reputation with respect to schools. They were known to be intellectually demanding, I knew, with an emphasis on philosophy. I knew that Jesuit trained meant something. Just after high school, I saw the movie The Mission. The movie tells the story of Jesuits in South America in the 1750s and takes place around the area of Paraguay. The mission, by way of historical background, is based on events surrounding the Treaty of Madrid, which was in 1750. And in that treaty, Spain ceded part of Paraguay to Portugal. And that part of Paraguay was pretty much controlled by the Jesuits. And at that time, there was impending, throughout Europe, suppression of the Jesuits. And this coincided with the transfer of that territory from Spain to Portugal. And at that time period, the Jesuits had settled this area in support of the native Indians of that area that were called the Guaranis. And in the way the Jesuits had helped or sought to help the Guarani Indians, they sought to set up sort of communal living. And they would, with the goal of protection and freedom from exploitation of the various European countries, primarily the Portuguese, would seek to enslave and trade the Guaranis. The Jesuits set up a lot of communities where they cultivated land, they made created livestock, undertook education. In short, they developed sort of self-sustaining communities, both economically and socially. But setting up these communities interfered with the sort of economic aspirations of various European countries and Europeans who sought to make their fortune in South America. So, under the Treaty of Madrid, the Spanish and Portuguese agreed upon the division of part of Paraguay, and that led to a war. And in this war, the Guaranis sought to defend their homes against both the Spanish and the Portuguese forces who were implementing the Treaty of Madrid and shutting down the Jesuits and shutting down the collective sort of farm communities that they created. And the Jesuits, we know, of course, is an order of the Catholic Church, but they've been suppressed within historically by the Catholic Church and by Europeans who resented their involvement in what they thought was the Europeans' right to do what they wanted. And so at various times, it must be understood, and this Pope is the first Jesuit Pope, by the way, that the Jesuits were at various times expelled from various countries. And they were expelled from Brazil, Portugal, France, Spain and its colonies, and various other countries. And at various times they were cut off by the Pope. This is one of these instances in the 1750s where we're looking at a time period when this movie took place, when the Jesuits were on the outs with the Pope, and the outs specifically out with the European community. So, this is the context for the movie, The Mission. And in this film, we are introduced to a Father Gabriel, who is played by Jeremy Irons. And I imagine a number of people have seen this movie. It was quite popular. Who is an idealistic young priest who founds a mission high in the country above an enormous waterfall in a remote part of the jungle. And he's joined by another priest, played by Robert De Niro. And Robert De Niro is a reformed mercenary and slave trader, and who is accompanies the Jesuits on a self-imposed penance for killing his brother earlier in the movie in a fit of jealous rage. And so, to overcome his self-loathing and dealing with his issues of guilt, he joins the Jesuits and deals with the very Guarani that he had previously been slave trading in. And so Robert De Niro, in this playing this priest, has a dramatic conversion and experience, becomes a Jesuit, and lives amongst the Guarani Indians above the waterfall. So the Guaranis are running a self-sufficient communal plantation, and they have but a sort of a precarious existence under the protection of the church. At that point, the Portuguese, who are slave traders, and while the Spanish are not, try to expropriate the Guaranis' lands and enslave them. And so in the context of the movie, just mimicking the events of 1750s and as it occurred, the missions happened to be in the disputed territory that had just been ceded to the Portuguese by the Spanish. So at that stage, the Portuguese want the Jesuits out. And that's been ruled by the papal emissary who goes to oversee the situation, who happens to be a former Jesuit, that would have to be the case. In other words, they'd have to sacrifice the Jesuit communities, the Indians in South America, to protect what the Europeans had. The Jesuits were going to be clamped down on Europe, or they're going to have to cede some points in South America. So the decision is they're going to cede some points. So as a result of that, That means the disposition, the dispossession, and enslavement of the Guarani, because the Jesuits are told by the Jesuit superiors that they have to leave South America. But Father Gabriel and Mendoza, both the De Niro character and Jeremy Irons character, both vow to stay with the Guarani. But they diverge sharply over the response to the imminent invasion by the mission, sort of the Portuguese Spanish force. While Gabriel, the very first priest, insists that fidelity to their vocation requires Christ-like non-resistance, Mendoza reverts to his military ways, organizing the Guarani for an armed response against the invaders. When Mendoza comes to Gabriel to renounce his vows as a priest, Gabriel counters with the theological rationale for not fighting. And Gabriel says, "What do you want, Captain? An honorable death?" And Mendoza replies, "They want to live, Father. They say that God has left them. He's deserted them. Has he?" Gabriel says to Mendoza, "You shouldn't have become a priest." Mendoza says, "But I am, and they need me." And Gabriel replies, "Then help them as a priest. If you die with blood on your hands, you betray everything we've done. You promised your life to God, and God is love." Later, when Mendoza comes to Gabriel, asking him to bless his fight, Gabriel responds, "If might is right, then love has no place in the world. It may be so, but I don't have the strength to live in a world like that, Rodrigo." So that led to the actual time of the when the Spanish and Portuguese force comes, and Mendoza and Gabriel both meet their death at the hands of the invaders. The military priest fell in the battle, and Mendoza killed later while attending his flock and having a Eucharist procession. And so all the natives are either killed or captured. So it takes no great leap of insight to see that Gabriel and Mendoza represent two divergent and contrasting Christian approaches to the problem of violence. Gabriel represents Christian pacifism, because God is love, as shown in the example of Christ. Christians can't shed blood in what may be a just cause. While the De Niro character represents the just war ethos. Force can be used to defend the innocent when their rights are being aggressed against. So it was my impression at the time I first saw this movie that Father Gabriel, despite suffering the same fate as Father Mendoza, is the hero of the movie. That is to say, the Irons character, the pacifist priest, is the hero of the movie. The idea that the Catholic Church would manifest these ideas, firstly the self-sacrifice of the poor, combined with the pacifist perspective, was quite shocking to me at the time. Certainly thereafter, the tenets of Anabaptism belief seemed a little less unique. And that begs the question then, to me, that how these two threads of Christianity developed, Protestant Anabaptist belief and Jesuit pacifist Catholicism developed. So I'm going to go through a little bit of the history of how Pope Francis took his name, and that will lead us to a discussion of those points. The Pope, this Pope, Pope Francis, took his name from St. Francis of Assisi. St. Francis was told, it is said, by Christ to go and, quote, rebuild my church. St. Francis of Assisi, as the name suggests, started the Franciscan order of the Catholic Church. Pope Francis adopted the name of Pope Francis, but he himself is Jesuit. So Francis came in around 1209, and he was said to have heard a sermon that changed his life forever. The sermon was about Matthew 10, verse 9, in which Christ tells his followers that they should go forth and proclaim the kingdom of heaven was upon them, and that they should take no money with them, not even a walking stick or shoes on the road. Francis was inspired to devote himself to a life of poverty. So, clad in a rough garment, barefoot, And after this gospel precept, without staff, he began to preach repentance. He was soon joined by a first follower, a prominent jurist, who also contributed all that he had to that work. And within a year, he had 11 followers. It should be noted that Francis chose never to be ordained as a priest, and his community lived as what they called lesser brothers, I guess lesser than the other brothers. And they lived a simple life, these brothers, near the town of Assisi, which, again, is the name. And they were said to always be cheerful, full of songs, and made a deep impression upon those that heard them. Now, Francis's preaching to ordinary people was unusual at the time, since he had no license to do so, and the Catholic Church believed themselves to have a monopoly on that. He was a lay preacher. I took a moment to say it's kind of ironic, because here we have a pope who's named after a lay preacher, and our Mennonite church is named after a Catholic priest. Francis composed a simple rule for his followers, which came from various verses in the Bible. The rule was to follow the teachings of our Lord Jesus Christ and to walk in his footsteps. And so Francis did seek permission from the Pope to put together a new religious order. Reluctantly, the Pope agreed to see him, and after several days of discussion, they agreed to admit the group. And so the Pope initially had his doubts about new orders. I could imagine why. But following a dream which the Pope had, he saw Francis holding up the Cathedral of Rome, that is the Basilica of St. John. And he decided to, on the basis of that dream, to endorse Francis's order. So the Franciscans were known to preach on the streets and have no possessions. That brings us to 1521. We started at 12, so approximately 300 years later. And we deal with Ignatius, who was a soldier. And he was described as a vainglorious soldier, which is to say that he loved going out and taking on battles. And after one of his battles, which is described as needless daredoing, he was carried home, hurt, to the family castle in Loyola. And with a lot of time on his hands, he was then given books. Normally, he preferred the sort of chivalric tales, but at that point in his life, he found them boring. And rather, he took and started reading a book on the life of Christ and the lives of saints. So the wounded Ignatius, his dreams of military success shattered, read on, and something happened. And when he thought of his old life trying to impress others about his exploits, he felt dry. But when he imagined living as a saint, devoting his life to God, he felt happy. Slowly he realized that his only way that he could go was with respect, is to choose life following God. In a more life path, a giving path. He decided he should do, quote, what I should do is what St. Francis did. So St. Francis, the decision of St. Francis directly impacts then Ignatius. And so just out of interest, and I talked earlier about how did these ideas come together, both the Mennonite ideas of pacifism and the other ideals of what we know as Mennonite thought. How do they come together with Catholic thought? Well, I spoke earlier that this is in 1521. Well, just out of interest, precisely at the same time period, in the 1520s, Menno Simons found himself to be a dissatisfied priest. He had been consecrated as a priest, and he had served in his parish for 7 years in his father's town and then in another town. But he would write about this period, about the fact that he and his fellow priests lived an easygoing life, spending their time, quote, and I quote, playing cards, drinking, and diversions as, alas, in the fashion and usage of such useless people. So that he started being a priest in the 1520s, exactly the same time that Ignatius was considering his call. So I need to give you a primer on what are Jesuits. So, first question, what are Jesuits? The Jesuit Society, known as the Society of Jesuit, Society of Jesus, is much more than an administrator of a prestigious American university. They're known as God's Marines or the Company. The Order of Priests were founded by St. Ignatius of Loyola in 1534 with six other students at the University of Paris. And a lot of confusion about things. There's also, amongst those other six, there's Francis Xavier. So there's St. Francis, Francis Xavier, two different people. So they sometimes get them confused. St. Ignatius had a military background, and early adherents referred to themselves as the Company of Jesus, hence both the nicknames that live today. Probably happy that Jesuits were not forming their own church like Martin Luther, Pope Paul III granted them commendation in 1537 to become priests. As head of the new order, Ignatius sent his priests throughout Catholic Europe to start colleges, universities, and seminaries. And by Ignatius' death in 1556, the Jesuits had already founded 74 colleges on three continents. With missionary work as the core value, the Jesuits have been known for spreading Catholicism throughout the world. Second question, what's at the heart of being a Jesuit? Under St. Ignatius, the Society of Jesus believed that reform in the Catholic Church began with reform of the individual. The founding member of the Society of Jesus took a vow of poverty, chastity, and obedience under Ignatius. Current Jesuits take the same three vows today, along with the vow of obedience to the Pope. So what is the relationship between Jesuits and higher education? Well, with its focus on education, the Jesuit order has been linked to some of the best universities in the world. Georgetown, for instance, Georgetown University in Washington, was founded in 1789, and today there are some 28 Jesuit universities and colleges in the United States alone. And there are 189 Jesuit institutions throughout the world. So since the Jesuits' beginning, they've been known as free-thinking, which has helped making their universities so well-regarded. This Pope attended a Jesuit institution in Buenos Aires. And so, question is, if Jesuits are so smart and have poverty vows, why hasn't there been a Jesuit Pope before now? And so, although Jesuits are now well-regarded, that wasn't always the case, and I talked about that earlier. The name Jesuit was originally a derisive term for those who used too frequently or appropriated the name of Jesus. Jesuits managed to retake the narrative on that, and eventually the Jesuits embraced the term, which was meant to be derisive. So, various European countries and the Pope, frankly, was concerned because the Jesuits became too influential too fast, and they were regarded as too elitist. So Pope, for instance, signed a suppression of the Jesus Act, which enforced in various Catholic countries, but not all countries, because not all countries would obey the Pope, as we well know. And so at various times, the various popes took different positions vis-a-vis the Jesuits. And so it should be noted that Switzerland banned the Jesuits in their constitution, and this wasn't lifted until 1973. So Jesuits are regarded as free thinking, as I said. And what does that mean? What's the deal with their poverty vow? And is there a connection between the Jesuits and socialism or liberation theology? Well, the Jesuits encourage toleration of other religions, teach other theology in their institutions, and believe in free education for all. This emphasis on free thinking, and especially the order's opposition to opulent riches, has some calling them founders of socialism. Pope John Paul, for instance, denounced some Jesuits in Latin America for their emphasis on liberation theology. And one of the links that was most negatively regarded was the link with respect to Fidel Castro, who was a former Cuban dictator, of course, and studied as a Jesuit for 12 years, though later Castro forced his teachers to leave, and that was in 1961. So Gnadius, of course, was the founder, and he had set out a formula of the Institute of the Society of Jesus, which is would kind of determine the fundamental character of the work and is their sort of fundamental document. And this kind of this in some of the respects, this statement reflects Ignatius' military background. And I'll read the statement that really reflects what the Jesuit order is about. It is, whoever desires to serve as a soldier of God beneath the banner of the cross in our society, which we desire to be designated by the name of Jesus, and to serve the Lord alone and the church, his spouse, under the Roman pontiff, the vicar of Christ on earth, should, after a solemn vow of perpetual chastity, poverty, and obedience, keep what follows in mind. He is a member of a society founded chiefly for this purpose, to strive especially for the defense and propagation of the faith and for the progress of souls in Christian life and doctrine by means of public preaching, lectures, and any other ministration whatsoever of the Word of God, and further by means of retreats, the education of children and unlettered persons in Christianity, and the spiritual consolation of Christ's faithful through hearing confessions and administering the other sacraments. Moreover, he should show himself ready to reconcile the estranged, compassionately assist and serve those who are in prisons or hospitals, and indeed to perform any other works of charity according to what will seem expedient for the glory of God and the common good. Particularly the last sort of lines reflects a certain statement of Menno Simons, which I'm going to read at the end of this talk. Ignatius and the early Jesuits did recognize the hierarchical church was in dire need of reform. Some of their greatest struggles were against corruption, venality, and spiritual lassitude within the Roman Catholic Church. Menno Simons, of course, was commenting on that as well, his own behavior, in fact. Ignatius' insistence on a high-level academic preparation for ministry, for instance, was a deliberate response to the relatively poor education of much of the clergy of his time. The Jesuit vow against ambitioning prelacies was a deliberate effort to prevent greed for money or power invading Jesuit circles. And St. Ignatius' innovation was to make this style of contemplative mysticism available to all people, that is, all the laity in active life. St. Ignatius and his Jesuit followers believed that the reform of the church had to begin with the conversion of an individual's heart. That may speak to the issue which I raised earlier of the camp discussion, that Catholics didn't have a personal relationship with God. One of the main tools that Jesuits have used to bring about this conversion has been the Ignatius Retreat, called the Spiritual Exercises. At the same time, Menno Simons began to doubt whether the bread and wine of the Mass actually changed into the body of the blood of Christ. Tormented by his own doubts, he decided to seek help in Luther's writings in the New Testament. But as a typical priest of the time, he indicates that he had never read the scriptures before, accepting the teaching that the church was infallible. He, quote, "I had never touched them," being the Testament, "in my life, for I feared if I had read them, I would be misled." In an attempt to address the scripture for himself, Menno could not find any evidence of the doctrine or transubstantiation. "I did not get very far," he says, "in it before I saw that we had been deceived." He concluded the meaning of the Lord's Supper was symbolic. He also had other doubts, respecting infant baptism and the like. But the correlation there, to great extent, is the fact that at that point, education generally within the European countries was flowering. And here we have part of the Reformation, of course, was education, the ideas. So dealing with ideas and studying. Those same ideas were brought forward by Ignatius as he's trying to reform the church. So Menno Simons rejected the Catholic Church and priesthood in 1536, casting his lot in with the Anabaptists. That was 1536. It was only 2 years earlier, in 1534, that St. Ignatius, with the six others at the University of Paris, started the Jesuits. This began the period known as the Counter-Reformation. And from my understanding, it may not be aptly named. And I say that because it wasn't to counter the Reformation. It was to cause a reformation within the Catholic Church itself. By extension, of course, they would deal with some of the criticisms that occurred in the Reformation. But it seems what the Jesuits were doing was to bring change within. So this is a period known for change within the Church, the Counter-Reformation. And it is the time period of the birth of the Jesuit movement. So we're dealing with a society, a European society, wherein there were a world of ideas that were springing up, both in the context of the Reformation and Counter-Reformation. Not surprisingly at all, many of the same problems within the Catholic Church, identified by Protestants, were also identified by groups that were wishing to stay in the Church and change it. There are many similarities of emphasis between the Jesuit order established within the Catholic Church as part of the Counter-Reformation and our own Protestant Anabaptist Church. It is the work of the Jesuits and this Pope if the work of the Jesuits and this Pope in particular resonate with you, it's not difficult to see what his influences were and how they echoed many of the issues that arose leading to the creation of the Mennonite Church. Hence my mom's view of this Pope having Anabaptist tendencies. And I would think he would argue that we have some Jesuit tendencies. So, with regard to this church, with regard to this Pope and the Catholic Church, how does this leadership of this Pope, Pope Francis, move the Catholic Church and by extension Christianity? Let me start by saying that the presupposition of Christianity is the fallen nature of man, and by its by extension, its institutions, including the Church. The Catholic Church has had more than its fair share of failings, and those failings have been broadcast wide. Why that is the case, I will leave aside today. Today, I want to consider the acts of this Pope. On the surface, this theology would seem to fit with Pope Francis. This theology being both the original St. Francis and the Jesuits. Here's what the New Yorker, summing up this Pope's approach to poverty and as being a Catholic. New Yorker states, he has made some sharp remarks about vanity, self-infatuation, careerism, and pursuit of promotions in the Roman Curia, which is the Vatican. As Archbishop of Buenos Aires, he apparently preferred to be called Father George, and was known for his preoccupation for the city's poorest, reportedly washing and kissing the feet of the patients suffering from AIDS. Earlier this year, Pope Francis made a decision to disregard church law. And this is with respect to the washing of feet. And at that time, church law, just after Easter, is regarded the appropriate time to wash the feet of 12 men, just as Jesus washed the feet of 12 disciples. And this Pope decided instead to wash the feet of a series of prisoners. And in those prisoners, he washed the feet of two girls, a Serbian Muslim and an Italian Catholic. And this issue became sort of a final straw, if there could be, for many Catholic traditionalists. evidence that Francis had little or no interest in the key priorities of the former Benedict, Pope Benedict papacy, which was to revive the pre-Vatican II traditions of the Catholic Church. In a way, Francis violated church law, because that was a tradition, and a tradition within the Catholic Church to do just as Jesus did and wash 12 men's feet. But Pope Francis, this is the advantage of being a pope, is the church's chief lawmaker. So in theory, he can do whatever he wants. John 13, 1-17 specifically mentions Jesus performing the act of feet washing. And he instructs, Jesus instructs in verses 14 to 17, "If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I've given you an example, that you should do as I have done to you." Certainly a pope, and by extension a church, that's concerned with reaching out to those in need, rather than being overly concerned with traditions, is a church that most outsiders would regard as a positive outcome. Signals that the primary mission of the church and Christian life is concern for the poor and the displaced. On the other hand, one may say that these notions are fairly commonplace. So how important can a change in emphasis of this post-pope be upon the life of the Catholic Church as a whole? And in that vein, I've been thinking about a particular article that was in Atlantic Monthly a few months ago, which I think has some relevance here. The article reviews a study that was undertaken in the United States, so I apologize for the solely American references, but I take it the Canadian statistics would be of a similar nature. And this Atlantic Monthly study deals with the issue of charity and who gives. So the study is as follows. One of the most surprising and perhaps confounding facts of charity in America is that the people who can least afford to give are the ones who donate the greatest percentage of their income. In 2011, the wealthiest Americans, those earning the top 20%, contributed on average 1.3% of their income to charity. By comparison, Americans at the base of the income pyramid, those in the bottom 20%, donated 3.2% of their income. The relative generosity of lower-income Americans is accentuated by the fact that, unlike middle-class or wealthy donors, most of them cannot take advantage of the line-item deductions that one can do with respect to charity donations on their tax returns. This view is supported by another study in the Chronicle of Philanthropy, in which researchers analyzed giving habits across all American zip codes. Consistent with previous studies, they found that less affluent zip codes gave relatively more. Around Washington, D.C., for instance, middle and lower income neighborhoods gave proportionally more than Tony neighborhoods. But the research also found something else. Differences in behavior among wealthy households depended on the type of neighborhoods they lived in. Wealthy neighborhoods, wealthy people who lived in homogeneously affluent areas where more than 40% of the households earned at least $200,000 or more, were less generous when comparing wealthy people who lived in more socioeconomically diverse surroundings. It seems that insulation from people in need may dampen the charitable impulse. Wealth affects not only how much money is given, but to whom it is given. The poor tend to give to religious organizations and social services charities, while the wealthy prefer to support colleges and universities, art organizations, and museums. Of the 50 largest individual gifts to public charities in 2012, 34 went to educational institutions, the vast majority of them colleges and universities, like Harvard, Columbia, and Berkeley, that cater to the nation and the world's elite. Museums and art organizations received 9 of the major gifts, while the remaining donations were spread among medical facilities and conservatories. Not a single one of them went to social service organizations or to a charity that principally serves the poor and dispossessed. More gifts in this group went to elite prep schools than to any of our nation's largest social service organizations, including the United Way, Salvation Army, and the like. So what happens, in seemingly in a predictable manner, is that people's concerns and consequently people's money stays in a fairly tight geographic area, sort of concentrically by interest and interaction. Likewise for the Catholic Church and for any organization. Its concerns become the life of the church and not its mission. Much note has been made of this Pope and his personal habits. All his gestures since becoming Pope point to simplicity. Paying his own lodging bill, riding the bus with his brother cardinals, and venturing outside the gates of the Vatican to greet passerbys. He doesn't like formal dress or formal address. After his election, he decided not to sit on the papal throne, choosing rather to stand to receive the traditional homage from the men who were until moments before his fellow cardinals. On the trip back to the chapel from St. Peter's Basilica, he chose to ride the bus with the cardinals, rather than take his papal car, which he was entitled to. When he appeared on the balcony at St. Peter's for the very first time, he would, in normal instances, wear a red papal cape and the customary golden cross. But he chose instead a simple white cassock and an iron crucifix from his days as a bishop, which lends me to think my vision in my head from the movie The Mission. It was priest who was facing the attacker straight on wore that same cassock, white cassock. Before offering his blessing, he asked the crowd for theirs and bowed his head to receive it. The next day, after praying at the St. Mary Major Basilica in central Rome, he stopped by the hotel where he'd been staying before the conclave and paid the bill himself. And he made that trip without a motorcade. So unlike the previous pope, Mr. Joseph Ratzinger, who resigned from the papacy in February, it's a good guess that this Pope Francis has the potential to become a symbol, like John Paul II, that resonates. During the voting on the papacy, who was going to be the pope, Bergoglio, which is the name of his original name, had been sitting next to one of his closest friends. Claudio Humes is the Archbishop of St. Paul. And in the moments just before it became clear that he would become Pope, while the votes were still being counted, his friend hugs him and tells him to don't forget the poor. And at those words, and Francis is reciting these events to various media. And Francis, when telling this story, talks about the poor. And right away, in relation to the poor, I thought of Francis of Assisi, the man that was committed to the poor. And he says to the gathered media, he says, "Ah," Pope Francis does at that point, now being appointed, "oh, how I'd like a poor church, one that's for the poor," and hence his adoption of the name Pope Francis. Now, this is against a backdrop of a Catholic church that has incredible wealth, vast real estate holdings, and the churches themselves, the actual physical churches, display a stunning display of relative wealth, particularly as one travels through Latin American countries and you see the massive church. Or one travels through Quebec and you see the towns and the massive church with the gold inlay. And, of course, Europe. Pope Francis, since his ordination, has set up a series of views related to the power of the Vatican Church, the Vatican City, which he evidently once diminished, the expenditures of priests, and scandals related to the Vatican Bank. Given his background, given the disparity of income, particularly found in Latin America, it is not surprising that this pope has those themes of simplicity and focus on the poor, and these are going to be defining characteristics of this pope. Just as Menno Simons was a product of his age, dealing with the same issues and concerns as the group of seven who established the Society of Jesus or the Jesuits. We have today a church facing similar cultural issues as this Pope, Pope Francis. In our recent history as Mennonites, in general, we were church of the displaced, displaced persons, and often of the poor. Here, at least in North America, within a couple of generations, that's changed significantly. In our day-to-day lives, we are pulled into the mainstream culture and mores, and not in an insidious manner, but just quite naturally. Inevitably, in that process, we create a church outlook that reflects our concentric circles of relationships and interests. That happens inevitably, and is subject, however, to concerted efforts to the contrary. But human nature is such that we are bound to look in our behavior and our views more like the wealthy zip codes or area codes than the poor ones. Our Mennonite church community has become defined lately by a mission of evangelism, of enlargement of the church. But for those in the church, Menno Simons said a faith that it cannot lie dormant, but manifests itself in all righteousness, works of love. It clothes the naked, feeds the hungry, consoles the afflicted, shelters the miserable, aids and consoles all the oppressed, returns good for evil, serves those that injure it, prays for those that persecute it. Very similar to, actually, the last couple lines of the founding document of the Jesuits. These ideas, no doubt, would resonate with Pope Francis. So I'll leave you with, finally, with some words of this Pope made by him just prior to the conclave that elected him, where he said, "There are two images of the church. The evangelizing church that comes out of herself, and the worldly church that lives within herself, of herself, for herself. This must give light to the possible changes which must be made for the salvation of souls." So thank you for listening to me today.